From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The Lives of Others. The film about surveillance in East Germany before the collapse of the Berlin Wall earned international acclaim, including a 2007 Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck tells us about making the movie. Also, we talked to actor David Duchovny. He stars in the new Showtime series Californication. He plays a struggling writer with a vast sexual appetite. Duchovny's best known for his role as Agent Fox Mulder in the TV series The X-Files. Film critic David Edelstein reviews Stardust, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Robert De Niro. And we remember songwriter Lee Hazelwood, who died earlier this week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. While filmmakers in Germany have explored the nation's Nazi past from a variety of perspectives in recent years, little serious attention has been paid to the years of communist rule in East Germany, especially the oppressive surveillance of the Stasi, the German Democratic Republic's secret police. The Stasi recruited and pressured informants to spy on their friends, family, and neighbors on a scale unprecedented even in the communist world. Many citizens had no idea who was informing on them until after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when Stasi records were opened for public review. The effect of Stasi surveillance on its targets and its spies is the subject of the film The Lives of Others, written and directed by our guest Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. It won an Oscar this year for Best Foreign Film, and it's now out on DVD. The Lives of Others tells the story of a loyal Stasi captain who begins to question his commitment when he's assigned to spy for weeks on a playwright and his actress girlfriend. It's von Donnersmarck's first feature film. I spoke to him in February. Well, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, welcome to Fresh Air. I wonder if you could begin, before we talk about how you conceived and made this film, with just giving us, our audience, a sense of the scale of the surveillance and brutality of the Stasi, the East German Secret Service.
Yeah, the Stasi was the vastest, most extensive Secret Service in the history of mankind, with 300,000 employees monitoring a population of only 17 million people. That's quite a small population. That's only just about twice the size of New York. And imagine 300,000 people trying to find out every aspect of people's lives. It was an organization that defined itself against the Gestapo. Very often people now say it was just like the Gestapo. Well, I mean, they defined themselves against it, which is why it was not an organization that used much physical violence. It used psychological violence. You know, while at the Gestapo, the Gestapo recruited thugs who would break people's bones, and the Stasi recruited intelligent psychologists who would break people's spirits.
I know that you have an interesting background. I mean, you spent part of your childhood in New York and then lived for many years in West Berlin, which is, of course, mm-hmm. was part of West Germany but surrounded by East German countryside. What contact did you have with East Germany and East Germans, and how much awareness did you have of the Stasi as a child?
Well, I had quite a lot of awareness because both of my parents are from the East, came over before the wall was built. But we had family and friends in Eastern Germany. Actually, an uncle of my father's was even chief of protocol for Erich Honecker, as the communist general secretary's office. And we often visited the East, and my parents were on special Stasi lists because they were considered traitors to the communist cause. And so at the border I remember one time when I was about 8 years old and my brother was nine, we drove over with our mother, and my mother was just led out of the car and disappeared in one of those buildings with these people for hours, and then came back all shaky and told us that she'd been strip-searched and humiliated in all kinds of possible ways. And my brother and I just thought this was, you know, very strange and somehow amazing that an organization could have so much power that they would be allowed to strip our mother.
Now, I read that part of the inspiration for this story, I mean, you wrote and directed this remarkable film. I read that part of the inspiration for the story was something that you read about Lenin, the Bolshevik revolutionary, mm-hmm. listening to a Beethoven sonata. Explain that moment and how it led to this idea.
Lenin had few close personal friends, and one of his closest friends actually was Maxim Gorky, the Russian writer. And after Lenin's death, Gorky wrote that Lenin had once told him, actually the quote goes something like this, he says, "The Appassionata is my favorite piece of music," Lenin says, "but I don't want to listen to it anymore, because if I do listen to it, and when I do listen to it, it makes me want to stroke people's heads and tell them nice, stupid things, but I have to smash in those heads, bash them in without mercy in order to finish my revolution." And, I thought, so this is what Lenin feels like now. let's see if I can find a way to force Lenin to listen to the Appassionata. And out of that, I constructed this idea of a man just sitting there with earphones on his head and expecting that through these earphones he's going to hear words of his ideological enemies, but actually he's hearing music that is so beautiful that it actually makes him rethink that ideology. That was the basic idea for the film. And so Lenin changed into a Stasi officer who's sitting in a surveillance center monitoring people. And so who would be, you know, playing that kind of beautiful music if not artists? So I kind of knew that was going to be the basic setting. A Stasi officer monitoring artists and changing through that close proximity with them.
And so we have this film whose central character is a captain in the Stasi who is conducting surveillance on a playwright and his actress girlfriend, and mm-hmm. kind of being very moved by what happens in their lives. He overhears intimate moments.
He just basically becomes part of their lives. They don't know that he's wiretapped their entire apartment and that there are bugs everywhere, even in the bathroom. And so they really go on leading their normal lives. And he takes part in that. And he's a Stasi captain who's so far been a specialist in interrogations. And of course, you know, in an interrogation situation, you never have someone just in their normal lives. Someone you don't have the opportunity to compare that to your own life. But because you're just always seeing them in that very same stress situation. But here he suddenly has, you know, this daily contrast of seeing how his life works and how these people's lives works. And I've often intercut it in that way. And you know what this artist's work is and what his work is. So that does make him change and think.
And the actor who played him, Ulrich Muha, do I have the name pronounced?
Yeah, pretty good. I mean, the sound, which is in his last name, doesn't actually exist in the English language, so it's actually Ulrich Mühe.
All right.
Yeah, it's one of those totally unpronounceable names.
with apologies to that, I mean, I read that he, because he was an artist who had grown up in East Germany, had actually had mm-hmm. some experience of being spied on by the Stasi, as so many artists did. And I wondered if that made making this film an emotionally difficult experience for him, or if it informed his performance in some way.
Yeah, I think, you know, Ulrich Mühe is a really very courageous man, and he was one of the first people to ask for his Stasi files. He was not like 90% of the GDR population, even of those who were monitored by the Stasi, that they say, look, we don't want to know what's in the past. We just want to look into the future and not know who of our neighbors and friends or family betrayed us. Ulrich Mühe was one courageous man who went there and said, look, I want to know about the past. And he did find out some quite painful things. He found out that four members of his theater group that are like a family, two actors, were actually just placed there in that theater group as actors to monitor him. He found out that he was on a special list of people who, in case of any kind of national emergency, would have been brought to special camps to be isolated from the rest of the population. He found out that his wife of 6 years, with whom he still had very good relations and a very beautiful daughter, had been listed as an informer with the Stasi, and that there were 500 pages of in her informer file, you know, including constant reminders to the Stasi that he must know nothing of this because he was an enemy of the Stasi. You know, these are things that were quite hard for him, but he'd lived through all that in the 90s. You know, when I offered this role to him and I did not know about his past with the Stasi, because he is a very private man, I didn't know these things. But I somehow suspected from all the knowledge that he had of the Stasi, most East Germans don't know that much about it, from the way how he knew that everything that I was telling in this film was accurate, that there must be something. And then as we became friends and as time passed, he told me more and more. And then I even convinced him to speak about these things, because I think that if you keep these kind of things just to yourself, it doesn't do you any good.
Filmmaker Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. His film The Lives of Others is now out on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, the director of the German film The Lives of Others. It won an Oscar this year for Best Foreign Film and is now out on DVD. The film is set in East Germany in the 80s and early 90s, and it's about the secret police and the people they spied on. I know that you spent a lot of time researching the book, talking to ex-Stasi agents and victims of their surveillance. I mean, this film is fictional, but was there a kind of moment and experience a story that sort of crystallized this, you know, this kind of surveillance, this story that you think really informed the film?
Mm-hmm. I remember when I spoke to the Stasi officers, I always had to find a special technique to ask them without having them feel my judgment. Sometimes I actually felt a little hypocritical doing that, but at the same time, I knew that I would have the last word because I'd make that film, and that would be my answer. So I didn't have to show any moral outrage at the things they told me because the film hopefully would show that. And I remember that, for example, when I had to find out about these odor samples, the Stasi actually took these odor samples so dogs would be able to identify who had been in contact with what and then maybe even be able to find the dissidents. I had to find out how that worked and how people dealt with that and whether it was something completely normal for them. So, of course, if I had now asked this person, the Stasi officer, these odor samples, did you really take them? Did you really do that? I think the conversation would have been over pretty soon. So I asked him instead, you know, these odor samples, did they really work? And that got him going. He said, yes, absolutely. Those worked incredibly well.
Now, I want to clarify for the audience who hasn't seen the film, how did they actually collect an odor sample of someone who is being questioned?
There were two methods of collecting odor samples. The one was if they didn't want you to notice, there was a so-called conspiratory odor sample, which was a cloth that looked like the cushion of a seat that you sat on while you were interrogated, and you would actually you would sweat, of course, while you were interrogated, and then they would be collected with gloves and put into a jar and locked airtight, so the odor would be kept. Another method, if they didn't have to keep it secret that they were keeping that odor sample, was that they would actually force you to take the cloth and wipe it between your legs and put it into the jar yourself. That was the more common method. And I asked him, did this actually work? And he said, yeah, it worked incredibly well. The dogs could always identify. Oh, no, actually. Then he said, I remember this one incident, it didn't work. There was a girl that we were interrogating and she had her period and there was just one drop of blood on that cloth, and the dogs were completely confused when I handed it to them. Ha ha ha. And he just suddenly started laughing. And then he said, well, you know, that's really weird. I haven't thought of that for, you know, like 20 years almost. No, so you're right. It didn't always work. You have to be careful of getting blood on there. So I just thought it was this really weird situation. I was sitting there in this guy's apartment, you know, a civilized apartment close to Hohenschönhausen. His wife was serving me tea. She, of course, had also been a Stasi worker because they were only allowed to marry amongst each other from a certain level onwards. And, you know, on the wall there were framed pictures of the grandchildren, and that really made me think of that saying about the banality of evil. You know, it's one of those things that, and it also shows you how close barbarism and civilization really are next to each other, even in our countries.
I'm wondering what you did to capture the look, sound, and feel of East Germany in 1984. How you approached
that?
That's a
good question because the question already implies something which I think is very true, that the Eastern Bloc did look and feel different. I think it had a lot to do with the colors. these somehow desaturated, washed out colors that the East had. There was something very, very unique about that. I even once spoke to a chemist who explained to me that there were certain patents that the East did not have, and therefore they couldn't make those bright neon colors that the West had. But I didn't simply want to do it by just washing out the colors or doing some lab trick. So I tried to analyze what colors were the most shockingly Western, and I actually found that it was red and blue. Those colors really throw you and seem very, very loud and extreme. And so I said, so looking at the pictures and films of Eastern Germany, I really saw that there wasn't so much blue. There was a little less blue. There was a little less red. And I went one step further and said, okay, well, look, let's eliminate blue and red altogether. And that's what I did. There's no blue object and no red object in the entire film. And I think it gives you that special feel. When we toured through the East with that film, people said, wow, this is exactly what it was like. And I think it's one of those cases where, again, fiction is somehow truer than fact. It doesn't look exactly like it looked, but it looks like it, like we remember it, you know, because things are made more intense in our memory.
And what about sound music?
For the film music, I managed to get my very favorite composer, Gabriel Yaret, who also wrote the music for The English Patient and for The Talented Mr. Ripley. I managed to convince him to write the music, and he wrote I think a score which really has such a strong message in it. When he wrote, for example, the Sonata for a Good Man, I said to him, look, imagine you can travel back to the year 1933 and get to spend 1.5 minutes with Hitler before he's committed his atrocities. And you somehow had to, you were not allowed to talk to him. You weren't allowed to shoot him. You can just spend 1.5 minutes playing him a composition of yours on the piano. What are you going to play? And so he wrote this beautiful sonata, which plays a very central part in the film. And I think it somehow does contain that message.
You know, I know a lot of German films in recent years have reexamined the Nazi experience from several different perspectives, and I gather. This subject, I mean, the oppression and surveillance under the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, and the Stasi, really has not been covered by filmmakers so much. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, I think you always need some distance from the things that you're describing. And it's only been, 17 years now since the fall of the wall. That's quite recent, the whole thing. I mean, think of how long it took for truly objective films about that time to be made in Germany. I don't know if we're making them now, but I do not think that a film like The Downfall would have been possible any earlier than, 60 years after 1945.
That was the film about Hitler in the bunker?
Right? Yeah, that is right. It was that film. It still caused quite an outrage in Germany, but I don't think that it would have been possible to make a film like that.
It's interesting because, I mean, I know that the East German experience, the German Democratic Republic, has not been ignored in German media, and I gather that there is something of a nostalgia in a lot of television shows about it. And
I'm wondering, that's true.
What is it that people miss about communist rule?
Yeah, you see, I think that people are actually a little bit confused because I don't think they're missing communism. What they're missing is the fact is their own youth, in a way, you know. But it's so hard to tell those two things apart, because while there was communism, they were young, so they think they're wanting communism back. Well, actually, they want their youth back. I think that's a large part of it. Another thing is, of course, there was a kind of social stability and security, or at least people perceived it to be that way. Wolf Biermann, the great East German poet, he once said, there's something incredibly attractive about the security and the stability of the life of a slave, and even going so far as to calling people their slaves. And I completely understand what he means. You know, it was also the fact that the GDR was living wealth beyond its own means. You know, the country, when West Germany took over, or when the country was unified, was completely bankrupt.
I'm interested in the reaction you've gotten to the film and whether the reaction has differed in East Germany, the former East Germany, and the former West Germany.
I think in the East, the reaction was perhaps more directly emotional. In the West, people saw it more as an informative thriller and drama with political context, content. In the East, people were, I think, moved on a deeper level. Very often after the screenings, and Ulrich Mühe and I toured through the East for about 2 weeks.
He was one of the lead actors, yeah.
That's right. He's the actor who plays the Stasi agent. We toured through the East for 2 weeks when the film was released, and people would stay in there for hours afterwards, still sobbing and telling us how it reminded them of the things that they'd lived through. And very often they told us their own personal stories. And very often they would add at the end of their stories, this is the first time that we've told these stories to anybody. People have not really been wanting to think about the things that they suffered over the past 20 years. Often people would also come up to me and justify themselves for the things that they did. And I say, look, you don't have to justify yourself to me. I can't give you absolution. I'm not a priest. But I'm glad the whole thing made you think.
Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck directed the German film The Lives of Others. It's now out on DVD. Sadly, the actor who played the Stasi officer, Ulrich Mühe, died last month of cancer. He was 54. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I walked in town on silver spurs, the jingle too.
Coming up, a conversation with musician Ben Vaughn about Lee Hazlewood. The songwriter died last week. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new film Stardust, starring Michelle Pfeiffer and Robert De Niro. And we talk with David Duchovny. He stars in the new Showtime series Californication.
Summer wine, oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off your silver spurs and help me pass the time. And I will give to you the summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
My eyes grew heavy and my lips, they could not speak. I tried to get up, but I couldn't find my feet. She reassured me with an unfamiliar line.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The new movie Stardust is a fairy tale sword and sorcery epic based on a graphic novel. The director is Matthew Vaughn, who made the British crime thriller Layer Cake. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Several hours after I emerged from the documentary The 11th Hour, in which Leonardo DiCaprio solemnly explains how humankind is doomed if our species doesn't work with instead of against nature, Brooklyn was hit by its first tornado since 1888. The next day, I watched Max von Sydow, a week after the death of Ingmar Bergman, failed to hold his own against Chris Tucker and Jackie Chan by a French taxi driver who just discovered his inner American cowboy. An hour later, I gazed on Robert De Niro in another film, under the direction of Madonna's husband's best man, as a closeted pirate captain prancing to the can-can in a tutu. I haven't checked the Rapture Index, but surely this is a cosmic convergence. The end might well be nigh. Apocalypse aside, I had a good time at Madonna's husband's best man's film, Stardust, a romantic fantasy that's very loosely based on a book by the revered graphic novelist Neil Gaiman. It has good and bad princes, a fair damsel, a wicked witch, a unicorn, a lot of corny romance, and some sick humor. But if it's overblown in obvious ways, it's disarmingly puckish in others. After about 5 prologues, a star falls from the sky into a walled magic kingdom, nestled somewhere in the English countryside, possibly west of C.S. Lewis's wardrobe. A young man named Tristan, played by Charlie Cox, goes off to get hold of that star, to impress the beautiful girl he loves, played by Sienna Miller. I've left out key details, but the big thing is that even though the star makes a stadium-sized crater, it's played by Claire Danes. Now, having to embody a star could, in theory, put an end to one's stardom, and Claire Danes doesn't have the refined features of Sienna Miller. But she's one of the few actresses who can bring off guilelessness. Accepting her, and not rolling our eyes when the white light radiates from her being, is a kind of pact we make with the filmmakers. Tristan gets to her first, but the villains are right behind, chiefly Michelle Pfeiffer as an old crone of a witch who wants to cut out the star's heart to stay young and beauteous. Pfeiffer turns her displeasure on the hilarious Ricky Gervais as a scheming but buffoonish black marketeer whose magic implements she seeks.
Due west, you say, and you're certain he had a girl with him?
Yeah.
You're sure? Absolutely sure? Sure you're not lying?
I'd cross my heart if I had one. Huh. Brilliant.
You'd better be telling the truth, you two-faced dog.
I can get you one of them, actually. Very good guard dogs. They can watch the back and the front door at the same time. Get anything you want.
What are the chances of getting a Babylon candle?
That one's slim. Although, I did know a girl once, if you know what I mean. I'm a ladies' man. Who had a sister. I think it was a woman. Oh, she was terrible. Face like a bag of frogs. Ugly frogs. Yep.
Enough.
Pfeiffer plays the same stereotypical shrew in Stardust that she did in Hairspray, but this time her slow burns have great punchlines. With exquisite annoyance, she flings out an arm and turns a goat into a man, a laddie into a lassie, and a rival into a flaming torso. When the script calls for witchy cackles, she does not cackle witchily halfway. She's also so stunningly, mythically gorgeous that she makes this phony universe seem real. The magic of cheekbones. The Pirates of the Caribbean people would have stretched this material out to 8-plus hours, while a visionary genius like Terry Gilliam would have royally messed it up by putting more emphasis on the world's wheels and pulleys than the narrative. The model for Stardust, luckily, is the Princess Bride, with a dollop of black adder, and to cut the facetiousness, non-stop rhapsodic heavenly choirs. As the capering queen of a pirate, De Niro is awful, yes, yet his gung-ho spirit wins him brownie points. Maybe his performance isn't a harbinger of the apocalypse. Maybe we can save the Earth and find a good part for Max von Sydow.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, David Duchovny has a new TV series called Californication. We'll listen back to an interview with the star of The X-Files. This is Fresh Air. David Duchovny, who starred as FBI agent Fox Mulder for 9 years on The X-Files, is returning to television, starring in a new dark comedy on Showtime called Californication. Duchovny plays Hank Moody, a novelist suffering from writer's block who indulges in booze, drugs, and plenty of sex. Let's listen to a scene from the show. Duchovny's character and his ex-wife, played by Natasha McElhone, are meeting their 12-year-old daughter's teacher.
I'm happy to report that Becca is a delightful student. Smart, inquisitive, full of life.
Yet I sense a big hairy butt lurking somewhere around the corner.
This is my life.
No, it's okay. He's right. But I'm slightly worried about her emerging sexuality.
Oh, thank God. She's a lesbian. Thank God.
What are you talking about?
I think we can all agree, by and large, that men are assholes. I, for one, am happy that she prefers the fairer sex. It looks like we're the proud parents of a lesbian daughter. Up high.
Celebrate.
Come on, don't leave me hanging. What? You're ashamed of our gay daughter?
What happened to your eye?
Okay, hold on a second here, folks. Becca is not a lesbian.
She's not?
No, based on what I've seen, no.
Then why are we discussing her sexuality?
Because it seems she very recently have discovered the attention of boys.
Well, she's beautiful.
She takes after her mother. The makeup and the slutty clothes.
David Duchovny didn't follow a typical route to Hollywood. After growing up in New York and attending a prep school on a scholarship, he graduated from Princeton and was getting a Ph.D. in English at Yale before deciding to move to California and pursue acting. After minor parts in several movies, Duchovny found stardom on The X-Files. I spoke to Duchovny in 2005. You, of course, are known to most of America as Agent Mulder from The X-Files, which, you know, became, an incredibly successful show. It was, I think, called by one writer in the New York Times the defining series of the 90s. And it developed a cult following of sorts. And I wonder if you, feared that you might forever be associated with this. You might become, a Leonard Nimoy, who we always expect to be a Vulcan with pointed ears somehow.
I never really did. I mean, I think that I don't want to compare us to Star Trek, but I think what separates the two shows is Star Trek was somewhat campy, I guess. And The X-Files always seemed to me kind of cinematic or filmic, and the drama realistic. And therefore, I thought that, yeah, playing a character is playing a character, even though I'm playing him every day for 8-9 years. And that eventually, after the iconic significance of that character fades away in the public memory, then I'll be allowed to move on. And if I'm not, it's mostly my fault for not working harder and for not being more imaginative. And if I'm not there, it's just testament to the power and the quality of the show.
Well, we looked at, as I was preparing for the interview, I looked at two X-Files episodes which you wrote and directed. And when the first one popped up, I hadn't seen an X-Files episode in a long time, but I actually remembered this one. I mean, it really stuck in my head. And it's about a baseball player in the Negro Leagues in New Mexico in the 40s who could easily be a big league player but always avoided playing well before scouts because it turns out he's actually an alien who's come to Earth as part of a plan of conquest, but fell in love with the game of baseball and went native and became a ball player because he loved the game of baseball. Where did that story come from?
It was the, was it 98 when McGuire and Sosa were having their home run race?
Uh-huh.
And baseball was on everybody's mind. And there was an article in the New York or the LA Times about a minor leaguer, and I can't remember his name, but he hit more home runs than anybody. He hit 70-some home runs for the Nevada something or others. So I thought, well, here's a guy in the desert near Area 51 who's hitting all these homers, and he's unknown. And I just started to kind of meditate on that idea. And then, also Roswell happened the same year that Jackie Robinson went to the bigs. So I thought that was an interesting coincidence to try to play with. And everything started to fall into place from there. And I liked playing with the ideas of aliens and alienation from society. And I thought it all kind of worked and came together thematically. And then the plot came.
Yeah, no, and it worked well because there's actually an alien bounty hunter trying to track him down and bring him in for having deserted his kind. I want to listen to a little piece of a clip of that episode. This is early on when you, Agent Mulder, are with Agent Scully, and you're going over records from newspapers in New Mexico, and she notices that you've actually been looking at some baseball scores. Let's listen.
Mulder! You cheat! I can't believe it. You've been reading about baseball this whole time.
I'm reading the box scores, Scully. You'd like it. It's like the Pythagorean theorem for jocks. It distills all the chaos and action of any game in the history of all baseball games into one tiny, perfect, rectangular sequence of numbers. I can look at this box, and I can recreate exactly what happened on some sunny summer day back in 1947. It's like the numbers talk to me. They comfort me. They tell me that even though lots of things can change, some things do remain the same. It's
boring. Mulder, can I ask you a personal question?
Of course not.
Did your mother ever tell you to go outside and play?
That's a nice little piece of dialogue. Do you remember that? Do you remember where it came from?
That came from my heart, really. You know, I love box scores. I look at them over and over. Not so much anymore because I don't follow baseball so much, but... there was something about the numbers and the box score and the fact, you know, my wife would say, you know, how do you read that? What are all those little notations and numbers mean? And it's really not that complicated, but it appears to be some kind of mystical, you know, sequence of numbers and letters. And I always felt it.
What did get you out of academia and into Hollywood?
Well, when I was getting my PhD, I always had the sneaking suspicion that I was in the wrong place and that while I could have been, I think, a good teacher, I would always be a mediocre academic. And I wasn't ready at the age of 22 or 23 to resign myself to mediocrity. I wanted to try to find something that I could be better than mediocre at. So that doesn't sound very ambitious, but I was looking for an out.
And
as I said, I started writing, and if I thought I would write stage plays, I thought I should learn how to speak the words that I was going to write.
You've had a series of memorable appearances on a lot of sitcoms. I mean, The Simpsons, and Sex and the City. And there was one that I really loved on The Larry Sanders Show, where Gary Shandling has the talk show in the HBO series. And you play a guy you play yourself. You play the celebrity David Duchovny.
Well, I play a character named David Duchovny.
Okay. This character, in this case, who has a sexual preference that's, let's say, open to some speculation.
Yes.
And you just do a wonderful job of making Larry Sanders feel uncomfortable. Yeah, where'd that come from?
Well, I had done the Larry Sanders Show one time. Through that, Gary Shandling and I became friends. And this was a year later, and he and I were talking, and I said, I'd love to come do the show again. And he said, sure, you know, come up with an idea, and we'll whatever you want to do. If I like it, we'll do it. And I called back sometime later, and I said, I think it would be great if I had a crush on you, but I'm straight, and I don't understand it. And it's a real crush. I just don't get it. And you're the only guy that I have a crush on. And he said, that does sound funny. Let's try to do that. And they wrote it up. And I just thought, my instinct is always to play it real first and to just, you know, commit to the reality of the desire. So I thought, you know, it's just going to be really funny if you're not winking at all. Don't wink at all. You know, what's funniest is commitment, not winking to me. So I thought, yeah, just caress his cheek and, you know, tell him that you're confused.
Let's hear some of this. This is David Duchovny appearing on the HBO series, The Larry Sanders Show.
Hey, could you give Larry and I just a minute?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Thanks. You're not upset that I'm taking Carol to the beach, are you?
Don't be silly. Of course not. She's a nice girl.
Oh, good. Well, I'm sorry I'm not going to be on the show with you.
What are you talking about?
No, my agent called, said the network went ballistic, and they put me back on with Jon Stewart.
Damn it.
No,
they're just not supposed to do that.
You're upset.
Damn it.
God, you're really upset, aren't you? You really care about me, don't you? Are you uncomfortable?
A little bit.
Okay. I'll see you.
See you later.
Bye.
see that?
Yeah, next time, kick him in the balls.
That was David Duchovny on The Larry Sanders Show. You know, I have to say, since you have such a reputation as a Hollywood hunk, was it sort of fun to play off that and as a guy who's struggling with his sexual identity?
Well, you see, what I thought was so funny was that I wasn't really struggling with my sexual identity. This was like a one-time offer, you know, and it was only for Larry Sanders. That's what I found funny about it, was the confusion, the kind of playing confused with sexual confusion, you know, and just kind of reducing it. And so that's what I was attracted to in that kind of a scenario. But in terms of Hollywood hunk and all that, I mean, I don't care, and I don't ever really think about it. I'm just getting along.
Just a regular guy.
Just getting along. Oh, I was an ugly duckling in high school. All that stuff. No, but I don't know. That just seems like it's on the outside.
Well, you've come a long way from the graduate program of English in Yale. Not only did you come to Hollywood, not only have you been in a hit series, but you are actually married to a beautiful actress. is it true that you met your wife, Taya Leone, when you both were auditioning to be on The Tonight Show?
That's when we first met. My manager had told me, you should get on The Tonight Show. And I said, well, why would I do that? And she said, well, it's good. You know, people see you out there and then they think of you. And I said, well, then I'll go. And she said, well, they don't really want you. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, you kind of have to, you kind of have to have lunch with them and they'll see that you are intelligent and you can speak and perhaps you can tell a story. And I said, I'm auditioning to go on a talk show. And she said, it'll be worth it. Don't worry. And I said, all right, I'll go. And so I showed up in the valley at this restaurant and I sit down. And now I'm not the only one auditioning for a talk show. There's actually a woman there who's auditioning at the same time. This was brutally shocking to me. I couldn't believe that somebody that I'd have to audition for a talk show and next to somebody. And Taya. She was married at the time, and she was charming and smart, and completely dominated the conversation. I became morose and withdrawn, and was not invited on The Tonight Show, but Taya was.
God, you failed your lunchtime audition.
Yeah.
Well, David Duchovny, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David Duchovny from our 2005 interview. His new series on Showtime is called Californication. Coming up, we remember songwriter Lee Hazelwood, who died last week. This is Fresh Air. Songwriter Lee Hazelwood died last week. He was 78. Hazelwood was best known for writing and producing this 1966 hit by Nancy Sinatra.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Hazelwood made a string of hits with Nancy Sinatra, including Sugartown, Jackson, and Something Stupid that she sang with her father, Frank. Hazelwood was also instrumental in creating one of the basic building blocks of rock and roll, Duane Eddy's guitar twang. We called musician and producer Ben Vaughn, whose music draws heavily on American roots music from the 50s and 60s. He's part of the cult following which developed for Lee Hazelwood's music. Vaughn told Fresh Air's Amy Sallet about Hazelwood's early work with Duane Eddy.
If Lee Hazelwood died in 1959, his obit would read, "The man who put Duane Eddy's guitar amp in a grain barrel." That may sound like a weird obit, but it was a very important sonic experiment that he did at that time that was very successful. He was a DJ in Phoenix, Arizona, and he started recording people there as a record producer. And Duane Eddy, he convinced Duane Eddy to play only the low strings of his guitar, and he put his guitar amplifier inside of a grain barrel to get a reverb sound that only he heard in his head. And that sound, of course, gave Duane Eddy over 30 top 10 hits, and he co-wrote all of those tunes.
So you think it was more Lee Hazelwood who heard that sound in his head that he tried to recreate more so than Duane Eddy?
Oh, yeah. Duane Eddy was like, I believe, like a 17-year-old kid at the time who was just wanting to be around the studio. And Lee Hazelwood was an older guy who had already been a DJ in town, served in the Korean War. You know, he was a man, older than most of the people he worked with. And Phil Spector actually followed Lee Hazelwood around and took some tips from him.
I know that you are a really big fan of his music. Can you tell us why? What is it about his producing and songs that struck you?
Well, what was great about Lee Hazelwood is he was a guy who started out in the 50s in the rock and roll business when it was brand new, and had hits with Duane Eddy, and then moved into the 60s. And by the time the mid-60s came around, music was becoming more enlightened with Dylan and the Beatles. And Lee Hazelwood also grew as an artist, and what he did at that time was phenomenal. It wasn't really recognized by fans of Dylan or the Beatles as being legitimate, almost novelty music to a lot of people, but if you listen close to the arrangements and the atmosphere and the poetry of his lyrics during that period, it's phenomenal music, and it's really lasting. I mean, you can listen to those songs now, and they sound more durable than a lot of the stuff that was considered heavy in the 60s.
Can you tell us more about what it is about that music that you love?
Well, it's interesting because you have a guy with a deep, friendly radio voice, cowboy. You know, he's from Oklahoma, and he's singing these menacing, mysterious lyrics. His voice has a little bit of menace in it also. And the arrangements, there's a mood and an atmosphere and a feel to the string arrangements and horn arrangements on these recordings that there's a lot of stuff happening all at once that never really resolves.
Is there a particular song that you would like to steer people toward?
Well, I think probably his best example would be Some Velvet Morning, which was a duet he did with Nancy Sinatra, I think, in 1968. The song is unbelievable, and it's been covered by a lot of people and mentioned by everyone from Nick Cave to Sonic Youth and people like that as a masterpiece. And that song seems to be the best one to sum up the combination of things that he could put into one piece of music.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna open up your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it in. Some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers growing on a hill.
anything else, Ben? Is there just any other thought you've had after you heard that he passed away?
The one thing about Lee Hazlewood that's really great is when you listen to his music, you know that he was doing exactly what he wanted to do. I can't imagine him taking suggestions from anyone. There's a real formidable vision there behind what he's doing, even if it seems oblique or poetically impossible to figure out. You know that he was following his vision, and I can't imagine anyone talking him out of that path ever on anything I've ever heard by him.
Ben Vaughn, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ben Vaughn speaking with Amy Salad about Lee Hazlewood, who died last week. He was 78. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
There's no one in this world for me. There's never gonna be. There's no one in this world needs me. There's never gonna be. And yet sometimes in my dreams I hear.
Sundown, I miss you, sundown.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Mr. Pip, a novel by Lloyd Jones about the lasting impact of one teacher's lessons on a small island during a civil war. From Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a period of change in Iran, but not for the better. We talk with BBC correspondent Frances Harrison, based in Tehran for the past 3 years. She'll tell us about choosing her clothes and her words more carefully to avoid harassment by the conservative Iranian regime. Join us for the next Fresh Air.